This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Here's the thing about understanding this economy, or one of them anyway. What you think the story is about sometimes isn't what the story is about. Two examples on the program today from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Wednesday today, the 6th of June. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We are going to spend a little time at the top of the program today with the preferred economic indicator of the President of these United States. He likes to call it the trade deficit. The experts at the Department of Commerce, whence it came this morning, call it U.S. international trade in goods and services. Month to month, the trade gap got smaller. That is the difference between what we sold to the world this past April, the month this report covers, versus what we bought globally shrank a bit from March, about 2%. That will make the president happy. This next bit, however, will not. Year over year, April of 18 to April of 17, the deficit's actually bigger, up 11.5%. And Marketplace's Kimberly Adams explains that once you dig into the numbers a little bit, you start to see how some of the recent trade disagreements, shall we say, are changing the global economy.
The trade deficit fluctuates a lot month to month, especially when you drill down into specific sectors. So while it looks good that the trade deficit shrank a bit between March and April, Lori Wallach at Public Citizens Global Trade Watch says the larger trend isn't as positive.
If you look at the first 4 months of this year, the U.S. deficit with the world is the largest that we've had since the 2008 financial crisis.
She says it's particularly bad when you look at China and Mexico. Take, for example, a monthly spike in soybean exports. It helped narrow the monthly trade deficit, but there's a bigger picture. John Bays is a market analyst who focuses on global agriculture.
Once retaliatory tariffs were mentioned or announced by China, export sales out of the U.S. to China virtually came to a halt.
So what explains the increase in our soybean exports? Grant Kimberly is a farmer and works for the Iowa Soybean Association.
We had typically buyers who were buying from South America this time of the year no longer were because the Chinese had bid up the market.
So with higher prices in South America, countries that usually bought from, say, Brazil, turned to U.S. soybean farmers, increasing our export numbers.
What we're seeing is rebalancing of trade flow right now.
Kimberly says this gives a bit of a reprieve to farmers who might otherwise be feeling the loss of business from China, but he says that break is likely only temporary. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Here's the thing about trade wars, as I think I've said. They are really easy to start, not so easy to end, because tariffs beget more tariffs, which beget even more tariffs, and somebody has got to decide to climb down off the ledge. We are at the first begetting more tariffs phase. Case in point, Mexico putting 20% import duties on American apples. We know a guy who grows apples. We talk to him from time to time. Patrick Smith is his name. His family runs Loftus Ranches up in the Yakima Valley in Washington State. Patrick, good to talk to you again.
Good to talk to you.
So we talked last time about a bunch of things, a little bit of NAFTA, a little bit of China. Now news of these Mexican tariffs on American apples. How's your state of mind?
Yeah, it's disappointing news to say the least, but not entirely unexpected given all the ups and downs of the trade world in recent months. So, you know, it's something that we're watching closely. It's something that we're definitely concerned with, as Mexico is the Washington apple industry's number one export market.
So given that it's number one, and given that you can't, as you mentioned last time, you can't get apple trees to make less apples, what are you going to do?
Yeah, that's kind of the big question right now. You know, we've got a pretty big crop coming up this fall, and so, you know, a lot of that crop is already set. The trees are you know, growing the apples right now, and we're not really sure exactly how this is going to play out and how badly shipments will be affected, but we could see growers not harvesting some of their lower producing or lower quality blocks, you know, just leaving the fruit on the trees. We could see, you know, a lot of fruit backed up into the market and then having to try to find different ways to, you know, to get rid of that excess supply.
So is that like applesauce and apple juice? I mean, is that what you do with leftover apples?
Yeah, so what we can't move into the fresh market would likely get diverted into some of those lower value channels like juice, sauce. Worst case scenario would be like livestock feed or like we saw a few years back, just dumped into canyons to rot.
That's got to
really unfortunate.
That's got to kill you.
Yeah, I mean it's because it's high quality fruit. It's fruit that was grown and harvested and destined for the fresh market to sit on grocery store shelves. And so we're keeping our fingers crossed that U.S. and Mexico can work this out before the 2018 crop starts shipping at the end of August.
End of August. Wow, that's not a whole terribly lot of time.
No, no. We've still got about 20% of the 2017 crop left to ship. And so over the next couple of months, we will start to see, once the tariffs actually go into effect, how shipments to Mexico are being impacted.
Right.
If we see a rapid slowdown in those shipments, that would be an ominous sign for the 2018 crop when it comes in a couple of months.
I imagine the Washington State Apple, you know, marketing group or whatever your industry group is, and the national industry group is jumping up and down on people's desks in Washington. Are you getting any kind of response from senators, governors, people in proximity of the White House who are saying, yeah, we hear you and we're going to make your case?
Yeah, we're getting some feedback from our, you know, our congressional representation that we need to understand better kind of what the end game for the administration's trade strategy looks like and how we can mitigate some of the impacts on our industry. But we do have various trade groups and interest groups kind of barking pretty hard at some people.
Yeah.
So.
Patrick Smith, he and his dad and his family run Loftus Ranches up in Yakima, Washington. Patrick, thanks a lot for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Kai.
On the other side of the country, in Lower Manhattan, on Wall Street today, what? Me worry? We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Here's a story that on the face of it is about one thing, but in reality is about another thing entirely. It comes with two establishing facts. First of all, even though the federal government plans to and is selling more debt, that is more treasury notes and bonds, the rest of the world isn't buying much more of that debt than they usually do. Second of all, as Marketplace's Abri Beneshaw reports, what the rest of the world decides to do with its money and whether they bring it here has a whole lot to do with what the Trump tax cuts are going to mean for this economy.
To pay for those tax cuts the government handed out last year, it's going to have to borrow trillions of dollars. But it can't just order people to lend it more money. It has to entice them.
When the government tries to borrow more, they have to sweeten the pot by increasing interest rates.
Kent Smetters teaches at Wharton. Now, the risk is that by raising interest rates on bonds, the government sucks up investment that could otherwise go to the private sector. Ben Page is with the Tax Policy Center.
When the government's running a deficit and issuing more debt, it's crowding out, to some extent, reducing the level of investment for the economy.
It would be like the government was pressing the accelerator with one foot and the brakes with the other. But here is where foreign money comes in. If foreigners come and invest in the U.S., they can, to some extent, counteract the drag on the economy caused by government borrowing. The question is, are foreign investors bringing enough money here to do that?
It's a key question in my mind.
One thing we do know is that foreigners are not ramping up their investment in U.S. government debt, so they aren't coming to the rescue there. But that doesn't mean they aren't coming to the U.S. at all. Kyle Pomerleau is with the Tax Foundation.
It also may be the possibility that foreigners are actually instead buying productive capital in the United States.
Productive capital like factories or businesses. That kind of investment could also help balance the destructive effects of higher government deficits. Too soon to tell, but anytime we get a clue about where foreign money is going in the U.S., economists get a better idea of how effective the tax cuts will be at stimulating the U.S. economy. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
We've been talking a lot about trade and imports and exports on the program today, but there is a major and really high-dollar American export that doesn't usually get much coverage in an economic sense. Hollywood, its movies and its smaller screen entertainment. And that is what you call a perfect segue into our next Corner Office interview with Charlie Rivkin. As of this past February, the CEO of the MPAA, the Motion Picture Association of America, the trade group that represents some of the big Hollywood studios. Charlie, thanks for coming into the studio.
Thank you very much. I have to say,
yes,
I'm a big fan of the show,
well,
and to be here as head of the MPAA, it makes me very happy.
Well, thanks for coming on.
You bet.
A lot of people will know you mostly or even only by the logo that flashes before all the movies and all the trailers, the ratings and all of this. What else does the MPAA do?
It's true. Our brand identity does come from the fact
brand
that we—
identity. You are a CEO, aren't you?
Well, it's the truth. I mean, the MPAA is seen on the trailers, like you said, and it's known for its rating services. But that is only one part of what we do. We are probably the premier anti-piracy force in the world. We open up markets for our studio members. We work with states and governments around the world to provide incentives for production, and we fight piracy as our primary goal.
Let me ask you, actually, since you mentioned it right off the bat, anti-piracy. Obviously, a lot of that in the news of late with President Trump and China and the intellectual property and forced technology transfer tariffs that he's putting into place. How does your business, your industry, feel now about the theft of its intellectual property?
Well, you mentioned a couple different topics, and if you want to talk about anti-piracy and theft of intellectual property, we are making some great strides. China is a different topic. In China, what USTR, the U.S. Trade Representative, is working on is continued access to their market for our entertainment product.
Are you suffering from market access both in China and around the world? I mean, it seems you can get American movies pretty much anywhere, man.
American movies are very popular in China, very popular. And China is soon to be, if it isn't already, the single largest film market in the world.
Yeah.
It went from about $800 million in 2011 to about $8 billion today. So it's a market that's very important to my members, and we want to make sure that our product is present.
You guys are out, actually, with a new report not too many months ago about viewing and dollar amounts and how basically you did it at the global box office. And I guess that's the key part of that question, right? It's a global box office.
It's a global box office. We make, I'd say, 73% of our revenue comes from overseas.
Wow. Wow. That's kind of amazing, actually.
Well, it's great because there's enormous growth outside of the United States.
Let me ask you what may come off as a slightly touchy question, but you roll the dice when you walk into the studio. We are at a moment now where because of the political situation in this country, the perception of this country and perhaps its cultural properties is changing overseas. How much of a concern is that for you and for your members?
Well, it's in many ways the golden age of content. When you say it's changing overseas, I don't know exactly what you're referring to. But
well, let me state it boldly. Right, President Trump is not making a whole lot of friends in many ways across the country. Right, with his trade policies, with some of his pronouncements on the way America is going to run itself internationally, and yet you have a product. Your members have products that depend, as you said, on the global market. Are you worried about that?
So starting with President Trump, I should say that my industry and me in particular, we were one of the first out in support of the tax deal that he put forward because our studios were paying a tremendous amount of money at a high tax rate, 35% versus the 21%. President Trump has shown a great interest in protecting copyright and property. And the president himself and other members of his administration had actually been in the entertainment business. And they understand that it's not just a great job-creating machine. 2.1 million Americans go to work every day in all 50 states. But it projects our soft power abroad. And I don't believe that our consumers around the world are confusing politics with entertainment.
In, I don't know how long you're going to be in this job, let's say 10 years. What
you tell that to my studios?
What does, well, you know, one hopes they're listening. What does the American film industry and your members, what does it look like?
Well, box office continues to expand. New markets continue to grow. So overseas, we're going to continue to see dramatic growth. In fact, China, I mentioned, went from 800 million to 8 billion, but yeah. China grew 22% last year. Latin America, 21%. But the growth to our member companies is not just box office. It's television. It's digital video services and home entertainment. And I believe the market will continue to increase as distribution vehicles increase.
Charlie Rivkin is the chairman and CEO of the MPAA, the Motion Picture Association of America. Charlie, thanks a lot for coming in.
Thank you.
That, of course, was not my whole conversation with Charlie Rivkin. We talked about the summer movie season, also why he is not really so concerned with that whole second screen thing. You can hear it on our Corner Office podcast. Coming up.
You can't barbecue your way out of this problem.
Hogs. Wild hogs. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial is up 346 today, 1.4%, closed at 25,146. NASDAQ gained 51.6%, 76.89. S&P 500 up 23.8%, 27.72. That's a palindrome, right? Brown-Forman, the company that makes Jack Daniels, gulped down 6% today on fourth quarter earnings that fell short of analyst expectations. Another cloud on the possible horizon. Mexico announced yesterday it's imposing tariffs on U.S. whiskey and bourbon exports. Diageo, the world's second largest distiller, off 1%. Today. Premium whiskey maker MGP Ingredients, which does not sound premium, slid 0.4%. Bond prices were down. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note thus was up 2.97%. You're listening to Marketplace. As a nonprofit news organization, Marketplace is able to do what we do every day thanks to funding from public radio stations, foundations, corporate underwriters, and listeners like you. Thank you to all the Marketplace investors who've contributed over the past year for helping keep public service journalism strong. We appreciate your support. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl with...
Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail. Or how the founder of the multi-million-dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. On the podcast How I Built This, host Guy Raz talks to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt, failure, and how they were able to overcome setbacks on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity, a how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. Listen early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more business content like this, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
Traffic in most major cities in this country not really getting any better. Those big urban areas are looking to expand public transit, even or perhaps especially places known for their sprawl. Metro Atlanta, I'm looking at you. Traffic there in Atlanta ranks fourth worst in the United States, and the city has had public transit for a while, but there is a drive now for a regional system. But to get the suburbs to buy in, there's a bit of rebranding that has to happen. As Stephanie Stokes reports now from WABE.
Marketing isn't typically the job of state legislators, but in the bustling hallways of the Georgia State Capitol, Senator Brandon Beach has had branding on his mind.
Sometimes a refresh and a rebrand is good.
He crafted a law to expand public transit around Atlanta so that it stretches from the city all the way to the suburbs. And one of his requirements is that the system sport a new name, the ATL.
I think with a refresh, it'll help and get people to be more accepting of regional transit. And so that's why I'm doing it.
The city already has a network of buses and trains, the ninth biggest in the country. It's called MARTA, which stands for Metropolitan Atlanta Rapid Transit Authority. But that name has baggage.
It's rooted in this racist history of suburban opposition to MARTA.
Alex Carner is a planning professor at the University of Texas at Austin. He studied MARTA. He says back in the 60s, the system was supposed to connect the city to the suburbs. The problem was people in the suburbs didn't want it.
There are stories of bumper stickers saying things like, share Atlanta crime, support MARTA. And there are also people on the record at public meetings talking about people getting on buses to commit crime, to steal televisions, etc.
Carner says it wasn't just about fear of crime. This was after school integration, when white people left Atlanta by the thousands. The city that MARTA would tie their suburbs to, it was now mostly black.
And so the rejection of MARTA at the time was a way to cement the separation of the newly white suburbs from the black city of Atlanta.
And suburban voters didn't warm to the idea of joining the city's transit system in the decades that followed, despite MARTA's efforts, like this radio ad from the 80s.
You know what a traffic jam is to me? It's sitting back with my earphones and listening to my favorite jams on MARTA on my way to work.
So could a new name shift mindsets now? Selena Barlow owns a firm called Transit Marketing. She's consulted with systems around the country, and she says rebranding can help.
The things it can do really effectively are increase visibility, make a system catch people's attention again in a new way.
But to make a lasting difference, Barlow says it has to come with better transit, like new rail lines or bus stops. In Atlanta, many people are open to changing the image of public transportation here. Outside a MARTA station downtown, I meet Jennifer Gurley. She's from a suburb east of Atlanta. And she says she likes the new name lawmakers came up with.
Everybody knows Atlanta as the ATL, so it's just kind of fitting to me that we would call our system the ATL.
The true test of the rebrand, though, may be in the coming years. The state's offered $100 million to kickstart the ATL regional transit system. But suburban voters still get to choose whether they want to put their own money in by raising their county sales taxes. In Atlanta, I'm Stephanie Stokes for Marketplace.
And now, an agriculture and wildlife economic statistic I am going to bet has not yet crossed your mind. Feral swine. Wild boars, or wild hogs if you prefer, are found in at least 35 states. There are more than 5 million of them. And they are responsible for something near $1.5 billion in damage and control costs every year. About a quarter of that damage happens in Texas, which is where Marketplace's Andy Euler went to see what might be done about it.
People say the town of Bend, Texas got its name because it's located on a horseshoe-shaped stretch in the Colorado River. It's a couple of hours northwest of Austin, population about 1,600 people. It's where I sat down with an 83-year-old local named Jackie Brister. Brister farms about 3,000 acres, mostly pecans and wheat. Nowadays, he also battles feral swine.
I don't know how many dollars a year damaged hogs do just to me, but I know some of those fields are going to be reduced maybe 50% in the yield just from the hogs.
He guesses the damages could be close to $100,000 a year. Feral hogs eat anything. They love Brister's wheat and trample even more of it when they're rooting around for his fallen pecans. Brister's ranch hand, Roberto Olvera, took me out to the fields.
If you can see over there, all the one is down, it's because the pigs, you know? Because it's not just two or three hogs, you know, it's a bunch of them.
Olvera said last night he spotted 30 pigs running through Brister's wheat. There are 9 metal traps set up around the field, and when Olvera catches one, he sells it to a meat processor one county over.
They will be and are the worst invasive species we'll ever see.
That's Stephanie Schwiff, a research economist at the USDA, who's trying to calculate the economic degradation caused by feral swine. She says the current $1.5 billion estimate is way too low.
That stops right at the farm gate. It only incorporates very few things. So yes, that number is going to be low.
The feral swine problem in Texas probably started in the 1970s and 80s, when rural landowners brought hogs to their spreads for exotic sport hunting. Problem is, they reproduce so quickly, the population just exploded. There's a saying in Texas that a female feral pig will have a litter of 10 pigs, and 12 will survive. Mike Bodenchuk is the USDA's State Director of Wildlife Services in Texas.
Research done here in Texas indicated that between 2006 and 2011, the population increased at a rate of about 20% each year.
And at this point, landowners are at their wits' end. They're hiring helicopter crews to shoot hogs from the air. Some folks in Texas are actually turning that into a business. In 2011, the state legislature passed the so-called pork chopper law. Chris Britz started his company Helibacon soon after.
Texas made it legal for the helicopter company to sell the gunner seat.
For about $4,000, Helibacon will fly you and a friend in the gunner seat, where for 2 hours, you can shoot at hogs as they scurry through the fields below. On a busy day, Helibacon customers kill hundreds of pigs in just a couple of hours. But Mike Bodenchuk at the USDA says it's become evident that trapping and hunting feral hogs just isn't enough in Texas.
You can't barbecue your way out of this problem. We're an example of what happens when you try.
That's why the USDA is in the process of testing a chemical toxicant, sodium nitrite, that would be put into hog bait. USDA economist Stephanie Schwiff is working with the team developing the poison.
No one likes a toxicant. Producers don't like toxicants. The general public doesn't like toxicants. Even the government doesn't like toxicants. But all the other management options are too expensive on a large landscape scale.
In an irony not lost on the USDA, in smaller doses, sodium nitrite is used to cure bacon. In Austin, Texas, I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, a nod to history because it matters. First of all, today is the 74th anniversary of D-Day, so keep a thought for that. Also, and important, but in a totally different way. Today, 84 years ago, Franklin Roosevelt signed the Securities Exchange Act of 1934, which gets us the Securities and Exchange Commission, as we know it today. Also, I'm told by a certain producer who shall remain nameless, Sex and the City, 20 years ago today. All right, Dow up 346 points, 1.4%. NASDAQ gained 51, 0.6%. S&P 500 up 23. 0.8%. Sarah Bergere, Jake Gorski, Drew Jostad, Jeff Peters, Dan Powell, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday engineer the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.